Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Edward Michalski, who has written the book Return of the Golden Age, Ancient History and the Key to Our Collective Future. Many people have said that if we fail to understand our past, we will have no clue as to go into the future. And I think that Edward has written a great book to have us understand where we came from, specifically in the context of a catastrophe that occurred approximately 13,000 years ago. And we're going to talk about that today and what it means in terms of our future. There's no question that we're not doing a very good job of stewardship of the Earth. And we could face the Earth throwing us off and trying again if we don't get it right. So this is a very important book on understanding the past to plan for the future. Thanks for joining us, Edward. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you for having me on your show, Dr. Susan. I appreciate it.
Well, do you want to give the listeners a little bit about your background and how you came to become interested in the ancient mysteries and the spirituality and consciousness aspect of the book?
Sure. I've always been a curious person, and for the most part, I've been a historian all my life, starting out when I was in grade school during the 1960s. My dad would bring me home these History of the World War II magazines by Marshall Cavendish, and I just like history. I like what happened in the past. And mm-hmm. In junior high, that got into more of the Civil War stuff, and you know, for the first 20 years of my life, I was really concerned mostly with U.S. history and the current history. But when I got into college and took world history, it dawned on me that we really didn't know a whole lot about our ancient history and about the origins of humanity and civilization. So that created some curiosity in my head. And I've been a writer all my life, writing poems in grade school, and I actually denied that to myself in college. I actually graduated from college from Illinois in finance, and spent a lot of my career in the financial area the first 10 years, and then writing financial programs for mm-hmm. banks the last 15 years. But what really piqued my curiosity was when John Anthony West headed up a team with Dr. Robert Schock in 91 to redate the Sphinx on a scientific geological basis. And it was an NBC special documentary, a two-hour special in 93 that I watched. And that kind of blew my mind because as I was watching, Dr. Schock was explaining the water erosion on the Sphinx and how it all happened. And it was like something that just could not be denied. I mean, here you have a scientist saying that the Sphinx is minimum 5,000 BC carved and probably closer to about 10,000 BC. Mm-hmm. So during most of the 90s, I did a lot of reading and a lot of soul searching. And that kind of invigorated this writer in me. And in 2002, I set off writing books, and I've written seven of them now, five of which have been published. And one thing leads to another, because in history, you find out where we came from and who we are. And that creates more questions in your head, which leads to a path of enlightenment. And it all gets mixed up. It's all really one thing: science, history, religion, belief. It's all one thing. It's all one history. And history is really kind of a memory of humanity. So that brings me to where I am now.
Well, let's go back to talk a little bit about what the official history says versus what some of the evidence says. Let's start in Egypt with the Great Pyramids and the Sphinx and the other great structures there. You know, we're told that they were built during certain time periods, but like you mentioned before, there's evidence that they were built much earlier than that. And then we're told that they're tombs for leaders, but that doesn't make sense either. Do you want to talk a little bit about that to see? I think most of the people listening have not heard the theories of what the pyramids actually may have been.
Right, right. Why the pyramids are believed to be tombs is way back in the 19th century. Here we're talking about the 1880s, 1890s, and the first part of the 20th century. The first archaeologists that went there noticed that there were cemeteries around the pyramids,
mm-hmm.
and they just assumed that because the cemeteries were placed around the pyramids, that the pyramids were also tombs.
Mm-hmm.
However, the main problem is that there's nothing in the pyramids themselves that indicate that it was a tomb. And there's no hieroglyphs. You can't really walk into them. You have to crawl mm-hmm. into them. The passageways to get into them are about 3.5 feet tall by 3 feet wide. So it's just really a very difficult thing to do. It's very obvious that the pyramids were not made for people to walk into.
Mm-hmm.
So this was an assumption that 19th century and early 20th century archaeologists made. It was an assumption really kind of based on the idea of Darwin and Darwinian evolution, because the idea was that, you know, prior to 3000 BC, you know, humankind were basically hunters and gatherers, and they had just started farming, and nothing older could exist that is of any sophistication.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, the books have been written about the pyramids for the past 100 years on how mysterious they are and how strange they are. But I spent a month over there in March of 2007, February 2007, and saw mm-hmm. for myself that there are multiple pieces of evidence that clearly show that power tools were used to create the pyramids. There's saw marks, there's milling marks, there's rotation marks and holes. Furthermore, being there, actually on the Giza Plateau itself, these documentaries, they never really show you what's actually there. There's all kinds of granite rubble around the Great Pyramid and the Second Pyramid and the Third Pyramid, and there's a lot of rubble at the various sites. And,
mm-hmm.
and walking there and looking through it and looking at the debris with your own eyes can tell that something very grand was built here a very, very long time ago. And mm-hmm. and history actually corroborates this. In the 6th century, the Arabs invaded northern Africa and took over those governments. And there was a few historians that went there and wrote about it. One doctor, physician from Baghdad, moved to Cairo in the 11th century, and he went and visited Giza, and he said that the actual ancient ruins on the Giza Plateau was a half day's walk in each direction. Now,
mm-hmm.
that's miles of ruins, and today we only see just a little bit because it's all been covered up by sand. Probably since then, the person who really came up with the concept that saw the Great Pyramid for what it is a man by the name of Christopher Dunn. In 1999, he came out with a book called the Giza Power Plant, and his idea was that the Great Pyramid was actually a device. It was actually a device to create some type of energy.
Mm-hmm.
So since then, there's been a lot of work done and a lot of books written on Egypt and Giza Plateau. I've written 4 on them. And it's getting very clear, even to technical people who are not only history-oriented, they're like, you mm-hmm. know, they're machinists, they're mechanics, they're engineers. Just for example, my sister's brother-in-law is a nuclear physicist. He used to work for nuclear power plants here in Illinois. And he mm-hmm. watches the History Channel, and he's seen many of the documentaries on ancient Egypt and the pyramids. And
mm-hmm.
a few years ago, I was talking to him about it, and him, knowing nothing about history, just being, you know, a nuclear physicist says, you know what, it was very obvious to me long ago, just by watching these documentaries and being an engineer, that these temples and these pyramids were not built by hand.
Right.
So we're kind of at a crossroads right now. The old idea of Darwinian evolution and that concept of nothing can be older than 3,000 years old is really kind of fading away. And the people are starting to embrace the evidence that, you know, civilization is a lot older than 3,000 BC, probably much older.
One of the things I wanted to mention to you, and maybe you've heard of this book, but there's actually a book by Colin Wilson called Atlantis and the Kingdom of the Neanderthals, 100,000 Years of Lost History. Have you read that book?
I've heard of the book. I have not read it.
Well, you need to read it because in the book is the scientific evidence of the tool that was used to make these monolithic structures. And that tool was, it's got a number of very interesting properties. He actually has the scientific evidence of its existence back then. It was kind of like a laser, but he said you could point it at your skin and it wouldn't hurt you. But it had these qualities. It could cut monolithic stone with the precision that you saw, you know, that exists, that we don't even have today. It also was used by the Chinese to desalinate water. And the really exciting thing about this technology is that it can be used to take away radioactivity. So this is something you need to research. He actually follows this back from the time of Atlantis and the proof that from the Neanderthals, but the time of the Neanderthals. But it was actually recreated by a guy, I believe, from Poland. And the amazing story is that the U.S. brought this guy over, I think it was in the 40s, and they created this really multimillion-dollar lab for him. And he came over, and he lit a cigar. And they told him, you can't smoke in here. He said, well, then I wouldn't have anything to do with it, and he went back to Europe. So the U.S. never got the technology because they were stupid, you know. But the Chinese got the technology and used it to desalinate water. But this technology needs to be brought back forth because obviously with what's happening in Japan, we have a great need for it to undo radioactivity. So definitely read this book because it's fascinating. And he has a huge amount of historical evidence of the actual machine that was used to cut these big pieces of granite.
That makes sense to me. I'm very familiar with Colin Wilson's work. He's been writing a very long time. It's being busy being a writer and reading myself sometimes.
Yeah.
Some books just don't get on my list to read.
Well, it was, for me, it was just an amazing, proof that who we think these people were like 100,000 years ago is totally different than what they really were. It was a highly advanced technological society, much more advanced than we are today. Using sound therapies and using, using techniques where they could make the granite molecules move at such a rate so that some of them would enter into the fourth dimension and then they could just move the blocks of granite with very little effort. You know, they would just move them up all the stuff that may have explained how they could get these huge, giant blocks of granite, some that were larger than, you know, tractor trailers, and they just seemed to move them with no effort at all.
Right.
And we don't have that technology today. It was the technology that was used to build the Coral Castle in Florida, you know, that structure.
Right. So, Mr. I've been there. That's a fascinating place.
It is.
Edward Leake Scallon. Yeah, and he refused to tell anybody what his secret was, and he took it to the grave with him.
But some kids watched him do it. And they said he was blowing into a pine cone. He would blow in, and it would create a noise, and then the rocks would float. And, you know, the explanation of that is probably causing the rock molecules to vibrate so quickly that they actually go into time-space in the fourth dimension. And then, of course, they levitate. And all you have to do then is just move them. And he did it all by himself, so he obviously didn't have a bunch of equipment, or the observers would have seen it. But all they saw was him blowing into a pine cone, which is very interesting. Yeah.
Well, from a scientific point of view, that actually makes sense in general, because if you look at quantum physics, we understand, and this has been proven time and again by quantum physics, that essentially everything is a vibration.
Right.
Absolutely. Everything there is a vibration. So if you can manipulate the vibration at the most fundamental level, you can pretty much move anything you want to move. That shouldn't be a problem. But kind of looking at the bigger picture, which is kind of more my specialty, I want to paint a big canvas of history to try and tie everything together. If you look at humanity itself, according to geneticists, we've been around 100,000 years, maybe even 200,000 years. So if you look at our little history of 5,000 years from when writing started at 3,000 BC, if you look at our little 5,000-year piece, we've gone to being fairly primitive 5,000 years ago to advancing our technology and going to the moon. So if we've done that in 5,000 years, there's another 195,000 years of missing history. So who is to say that humanity hasn't achieved a sophisticated civilization 10 times, 20 times, and those civilizations have been destroyed by some sort of global catastrophe?
Right.
You know, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, it also makes sense from the standpoint of how paranoid we are about the world coming to an end, which you point out very nicely in your book.
That's absolutely true. That's a very strange topic, because this whole world coming to an end really has a Christian origin to it. Here we're going back about 150 years to Great Britain, Scotland, actually. And this whole concept of an antichrist and the end of the world, it started in Britain, and then it came to America with Reverend Schofield and spread throughout America with the Schofield Bible. But ever since then, even during the 1840s, there was the Millerites here in the United States that they believed Jesus was coming back and the world was going to end. And there's been cult groups since that, ever since. And even today, you know, 30 years ago when I was a young man, the whole Israel thing and invading Lebanon, you know, it was the end of the world. You know, Jesus coming back. And even in the 30 years since, there's always some idea. And what's really odd about this is the end of the world is always just a few years away. But the end of the world never happens. And it keeps being pushed back a little bit. So the question I've always had was, well, where did this fundamental idea of the world coming to an end come from? Well, if we look at ancient history, and here we have to get into mythology, and mythology is actually humanity's first memories as far as we know. Once you start looking at mythology, and start looking at the different cultures that have written mythologies, you know, the Egyptians, the Sumerians, the Greeks, the Hindus, and even the Norse people, they have very, very different stories, but there's a very common theme to their stories, and that story is the death of gods, okay? And it always involves catastrophe. So, looking at that myth and assuming it is actual history, and then trying to find in actual science what may have happened, you can find where the myth starts to overlap with the actual science. And for the longest time, most people, this is how it was taught in the schools, most people and scientists really did not understand the end of the Ice Age. The end of the Ice Age was about 12,000 years ago. It was about 10,000 BC. And this was a very crucial time for humanity because all of a sudden the climate changes. And then you have humanity starting to farm and domesticate animals. Well, for the longest time, there was all kinds of strange ideas. I call them strange because I think that they're kind of unbelievable. That something happened to our orbit of the planet. It became more elliptical as opposed to circular, and this created the climate change. It was a very gradual change. And, you know, the species died out because they couldn't survive in the climate. However, new science in the last 20 years have figured out that something very bad happened to our planet 12,000 years ago.
Right.
And the ground zero of this impact of destruction from outer space actually occurred in the Great Lakes area of North America. But it affected the entire world. And specifically what it is, there's several theories on this, but the theory I favor is that a 12,000, and this is verified science too, 12,000 years ago, a star in the Vela system went to supernova, and it spewed out plasma shrapnel in all directions. And what this plasma shrapnel is the material of the star that has become so hot, and here we're talking about tens of millions of degrees, it's become so hot that atoms can't exist. You have actually rapidly free-moving neutrons, electrons, and protons. Mm-hmm. And anyway, a fireball shot through our solar system 12,000 years ago. And it rearranged the orbits of our planets. And it probably impacted Venus. That's why Venus is like it is today. But it came very near Earth and pulled a lot of dust around the inner planets and created solar flares. So there's this combination of this plasma coming through, pushing dust to the inner planets, creating solar flares that created a great conflagration on our planet Earth. And nearly destroyed the planet. This is recorded in numerous mythologies. For example, in ancient Egypt, this is caught in the story of Hathor and the Eye of Ra. As the story goes, Ra, who is the sun god, becomes upset at mankind. And what he does is he gets Hathor, another goddess, to use the Eye of Ra to come to Earth and destroy Earth. But while she is destroying Earth, he changes his mind and has the priests on Earth make a batch of beer and blood to pour into the fields. So Hathor will drink the beer and blood, become drunk, and forget about destroying the planet, which she does. So mankind is saved. Now, what's really interesting about the end of this mythology is that at the very end of the story, Ra is still upset at mankind because they won't change their ways. So Ra leaves the area. He actually leaves the field. And then the stars are born. Now, that's really crazy for us to think about. It really doesn't make any sense to us today. Because the solar system is as it is, and we assume that it's always been like that. But a man named David Talbot has done a lot of work on mythology and the very first mythologies. And he has pulled in a physicist by the name of can't remember his name. But this physicist has actually proven in the laboratory that the scarring on Mars and some of the scarring on Earth here and the iconography that we see all around the world in all various cultures, that's the first iconography, the first pictures, petroglyphs of humanity are all the same thing. They all involve a circular object with a cross through it or stars and two other objects in the center. Well, what's truly fascinating is that the Sumerians put the finger on this. In ancient Sumerian cuneiform text writing, they have a series of omens, and a number of these omens talk about the planet Saturn. And one omen refers to Saturn being in the shadow of the moon. Well, today this is an impossibility. Saturn cannot be in the shadow of the moon. That just doesn't work like that. But looking further into it, if you study Sumerian cuneiform writing, you see that the Sumerians were referring to the planet Saturn as a sun,
right,
as well as referring to the daytime sun as a sun. And it's a real piece of language that is just like one syllable different in referring to the planet Saturn as opposed mm-hmm. to the actual daytime sun. So it seems obvious the case that our planets were in a very, very different orbit 12,000 years ago. And mm-hmm. Saturn, Venus, and Mars were orbiting very nearby planet Earth. Now, this corroborates with the Egyptian story of Hathor and the Eye of Ra, because they say when Ra left, who was actually supposed to be the sun, when Ra left, the stars were born. And also
right.
Ra, you know, Saturn is called Father Time. Well, mm-hmm. if you think about it, how we measure time today, it is actually by the stars. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The Naval Observatory in Annapolis, Maryland, actually is the correct timekeeper for our nation and the world. They shoot the stars to make sure our calendar is correct. Well, if our planet was orbiting nearby Saturn, and according to the mythology, Saturn was to the north, and it took up most of the night sky. Saturn is a luminous planet. It has its own energy that it spews out. It's not
mm-hmm.
nearly as powerful as the sun, but it does glow. So if we had Saturn orbiting near us, we would not be able to see the stars at night. Just like
right.
in a large city, you can't see the stars because the glow of the city
blocks too much light. Right, yeah.
That's exactly right. So what happened is that this fireball messed up the orbits of the planets and separated Earth, Saturn, Mars, and Venus that were mm-hmm. that were orbiting close by. This matches up with the way the Sumerians talk about it, with the way the Egyptians talk about it. It also matches up with the iconography of the ancients.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened to create this whole idea of the end of the world. The end of the world actually did happen in recent history, 12,000 years ago.
Wasn't that also the time of the Great Flood?
That's correct. And
that may have been also, I watched a show last night on Big History called about meteors. And there have been times, and maybe 12,000 years ago was one of those times, where there were a number of meteors that hit the Earth. They talk about the dinosaurs becoming extinct because of a giant, 6 mile across meteor hitting the Earth.
Right.
And then
it's
causing a nuclear winter. Yeah. So
right.
the great cataclysms could have been meteors and plasma, you know, streams like you were talking about. And the Great Flood could have been due to meteors as well. I mean, simultaneously hitting the Earth.
Well, the Great Flood that we read about in the Bible, that is actually a later version that's all about a water flood. But we historians know, and it's been proven to be an actual fact, that the Epic of Gilgamesh actually precedes the Great Flood by several thousand years. And the story of Gilgamesh, from which the Noah Flood story is taken, is actually a much longer story. The Epic of Gilgamesh is approximately 20,000 words. And the Epic of Gilgamesh very clearly sets the stage on what this flood is. All the characters in the Gilgamesh story are planets, Mercury,
mm-hmm.
Venus, Earth. Gilgamesh, the character Gilgamesh himself is actually Earth. It's not a person. Okay?
So was this different than the Noah flood, though? Is the Gilgamesh flood different, or is it the same?
Well, it's the same story, but the Gilgamesh story is a much longer and more thorough story. The Noah flood is a very shortened story, and because it's separated by 2,000 years in time, the story of Noah's flood is really a diluted, shortened version, and actually it's kind of a bastardized part of the story, because if you read Noah's story, you get the idea that water caused all the damage in this flood. But that's not actually the case. The flood was actually a celestial flood. And what is meant by that, and this is an old, ancient way of referring to the night skies, about a flood and about the waters, the way they refer to the constellations and stars in the sky is that the ecliptic of our Earth, meaning the equator, and its plane that extends forever, if stars were above that plane, they were above the water. If stars or constellations fell below the equator out of sight, it was to say that they were below the water. So this whole concept of the night sky being an ocean kind of dovetails into the whole concept of Noah's flood being a water flood, even though it's not really a water flood. It's a celestial flood from space. So that's kind of what happened to Noah's flood as it relates to the epic of Gilgamesh.
Okay. So what was the 12,000 years ago? Was that is there scientific evidence that there was actually a worldwide flood then?
No, there's no evidence that there was an actual worldwide flood. There is evidence that there were floods in many areas. Okay, there's also evidence that our planet was hit by cosmic waves. One scientist claims that it was a gamma ray burst, which is almost the same thing. A gamma ray burst is almost the same thing as a ball of plasma coming through our solar system. It's going to have the same effect. It's going to push rocks and debris and planetoids from the outer Oort cloud into the core area of the inner planets. So it's kind of the same thing.
So what can you describe what you think happened during this cataclysm? I mean, what was the sequence of events, and how did it affect animal, plant, and human life?
The first thing that would happen would be a burst of radiation, okay, and that would destroy part of the ozone. Okay, and the ozone is what protects our planet from cosmic rays.
Right.
So after our ozone gets destroyed, the planet's going to start heating up, and the radiation is going to start killing both animal life and vegetable life. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after that, from the actual force of this plasma ball coming through, as it enters our atmosphere, our solar system is enclosed in what they call the Oort cloud, which is a bunch of debris and rock that encircles our entire solar system. Okay, all this debris is going to be pushed in to towards the sun, and once it reaches the sun, it's going to actually act as fuel to heat up the sun. Okay, so you're going to get more solar flares, so that's going to create greater heat. This debris is also going to bombard the planets. So the Earth is also going to get hit by meteors, and it's probably going to get hit in many different places.
Right.
So that's going to even create a more devastating effect on the planet. So what you have is you have the planet heating up, and then you have the planet being bombarded by meteors, okay?
And comets, right? Because comets are ice.
Right.
Both meteors and comets, right?
Right. So basically you have Earth being turned into a hell.
Well, wait a minute, but that's what's happening now. We have global warming, which isn't really global. It's a whole solar system. We have increased solar flares. We have increased comet and meteorite activity. So isn't this something that's happening every 12, 13,000 years?
It could be that there are some people that believe that there's a 12,000-year cycle.
Yeah, because my brother was on he was the head of the Ozone Committee for the country. He used to testify in front of Congress. So I'm up on ozone because I talk to my brother intermittently. The ozone's going away again, and cosmic rays are at their all-time high. I mean, it sounds like the same thing's happening. And, you know, we are not producing global warming. I mean, mankind is not responsible for global warming. He says the pine trees around Atlanta and the southeast produce, you know, more problems than mankind ever produced.
Right.
You know, so I think it's happening again from what you're saying.
It very well could be. And this brings, you know, humanity into the picture.
Yeah.
Because I think that humanity really creates its own environment, and how we feel, believe, and act, okay, is reflected in the stars around us and where we are in the solar system and where we are in the galaxy. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The stars really don't affect us like astrologers think, but it's actually the reverse, that our own consciousness, okay, is reflected in the stars. So, long story short, is that we need to shape up as a human society and start taking care of ourselves and the planet, or we might get destroyed again and start all over again.
Well, there's little doubt that the elite are preparing for some sort of disaster. I mean, if you watch Jesse Ventura and you know, conspiracy theory, and look at all the underground building and the you know, all of the stuff under the Denver airport and, you know, just everything. The evidence is that the people who are so-called running the planet are preparing for something of a fairly significant disaster that matches exactly what your painting happened 12,000-13,000 years ago.
Right.
Go underground, you know, go
right.
Down deep where you can't get radiated.
Right. There's. I mean. That's one angle to look at it, and that's a, you know, that could very well be true. But there's another angle to the elite of the world building these bunkers and forts and all these safe houses, is that there's another phenomenon that's going on right now that I also get into fairly deeply in the book Return of the Golden Age, is that humanity itself worldwide seems to be waking up to what's real and what's not real. Okay, there's a mass movement around the globe right now where people are becoming politically awakened, they become socially awakened. They're understanding that they're being exploited and taken advantage of, and that the earth is being pilfered for its natural resources and kind of destroyed. So you know, this movement, you know, is building. A couple of years ago, they had the Occupy Wall Street movement started here in the States, and this whole Occupy movement spread around the world. It wasn't just happening here in the States. It was happening in Canada. It was happening in Europe. And then, of course, you have the Arab Spring going on. So you know, the way I kind of see the elite, the truly powerful people here today, is that they're getting really nervous that the human population is starting to understand exactly what's going on and that they want things changed. So in fear of some kind of revolution, they're building safe houses for that.
Well, it could be. You mentioned in your book Thrive by Peter Gamble and Zeitgeist. These are two good sources for people to look up on the internet that explain the structures of the power that be and the relationship of the banking institutions and the corporations, multinational global corporations, and the families that own them, and how you know, the status quo is maintained and the regular media is, you know, is just controlled by the powers that be and tries to keep everybody in line. And
Right. This is how I tie the golden age of the future together with the golden age of the past.
Is
when 12,000 years ago, when our planet was almost completely destroyed, those survivors that made it through that catastrophe, you know, they inherited a planet of desolation, and they had they had to figure out how to live and how to survive. Okay, so you know, just pretend today that this catastrophe actually happens, and we wake up tomorrow, and 80% of the population is gone, and our planet is nearly barren, and it's hard to survive. Well, the people who survive that catastrophe are going to be terrorized. They're going to be shocked. How do we do this? It's a mindset of how do we survive. And unfortunately, back then, it's, you know, in order to survive, we have to kill. We have to kill animals to eat. We have to kill people that want to take our resources. This is the fundamental concept that is a great overarching concept of all of human history for the past 12,000 years.
Yeah,
it's the domination. It's the domination of resources. And what's really interesting about this point about domination is that if you look at the religious texts, and I'm not just picking on the Bible, there's other religious texts besides the Bible that state this. The entry point for domination was the female. Okay? And after the domination of the female by men, it became the domination of a structured city-state. And then that spread into the domination of a kingdom, and then the domination through empire. And that brings us forward to today, where we've kind of gotten away of the military force of an empire, and we've created an economic empire, the Anglo-American economic empire. But my point is, it's the same method of operation, okay? The people who...
We're economic slaves rather than... You know, actual slaves.
Exactly. Instead of being in abject slavery, we're in economic slavery.
Right.
And this is another point that I'd really like to make, and I've been making it in the last several radio shows that I have done. A lot of people blame the government for everything that's going on. Well, that's unfair, okay? Because the true power that gives people their livelihood is not the government. The true power that gives people their livelihood are the giant corporations that employ people.
Right.
Okay.
This is
a really simple point. There's two sectors in life. There's what's called the public sector, and then there's what's called the private sector. The public sector has to do with the government, how it operates with the people, and how it operates with the cities and states. Now, with the public sector, we are protected by the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Free speech, freedom of religion, the right to own and bear arms, and such. Okay? Those rights are guaranteed by the Constitution. Well, in the private sector, that's really controlled by business and corporations. Guess what? We're
none of that applies. That's
exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And I'll tell you something. As a radio show host, I've been doing this show for 17 years, interviewing a different author every week. I interview all of the whistleblowers. And all of the whistleblowers, including myself, can promise you that the private sector goes beyond and above what they can do to silence us, including things that are objectively illegal.
That's correct. That's correct. And the easiest way they do that is through belief system. And this has been going on since I was born. When the television came out in the 50s and became extremely popular in the 60s, it was a very easy way of telling the people what to think and how to act. And it's been that way ever since. What's interesting is that the internet, which actually came about around 93-94, the internet has turned the apple cart upside down.
That's
because now the average person has the ability to talk with anyone anywhere in the world about anything, to uncover the truth. And they're broadcasting themselves. Like you and your radio show, there's hundreds, maybe even thousands of other radio shows talking about the truth as opposed to, you know, some major television station creating public opinion.
And even the other television stations that are on now, the History Channel, the Biography Channel, the Science Channels, are full of information about ETs, ancient alien history, you know, the big history that I was watching the other day. It's getting around the media controlled by the powers that be. It's just getting around it.
That's absolutely correct, and that's why they're building the bunkers everywhere.
Right. The building. That's why they're building the bunkers. That's great. Oh, I think you may be right. But I also think that they think there's something else coming.
That could be very good.
Well, look
true.
At the chemtrails. Why would you be putting chemtrails up in the sky if you weren't trying to block something?
You know what? 2 years ago, I live here in Lincoln, Illinois. It's not a very big town. Mm-hmm. Population about 15,000 people. It's smack dab in the center of the state.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, I woke up and looked up, and there was a giant chemtrail X over our town.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I took pictures of it, and it was very distinctly. I'm used to seeing vapor trails in the air from planes flying all over. You know, we all know what they look like.
Right.
But when I woke up that day and looked out, there was a great big X, and these chemtrails weren't high up. It was a lot lower. It was maybe only 3,000 or 4,000 feet in the air, as opposed to 30,000 feet where a plane flies.
Right.
So, the whole chemtrail thing is real, too.
Well, it's just interesting. You have to piece everything together, as I'm sure you do. It's a big puzzle. And the chemtrails are important. What's the depopulation ideas are important. The trying to get the resources and the population matched up so that we have enough resources for the population that exists. These are all part of the plans of the powers that be. And the question is, are they doing it for ethical and high-minded reasons, or are they doing it for power and control reasons?
Well, yeah, I think what we have to do to understand what they're thinking is, let's put ourselves in their place.
Mm-hmm.
Let's pretend that me and you are worth billions, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we're sitting on top of the hill. How would we act in this situation? Well, the first thing you want to do is you want to protect yourself and you want to protect your wealth.
Okay? Right.
Now, you need people as workers. That's a must.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The problem becomes is when there's too many people. Okay.
They can revolt. So, that's has always happened.
Correct.
Every revolution is because too many people are unhappy. I mean, you don't have a revolution unless you have unhappy people.
That's correct. And what has happened in the past 100 years, specifically in the past 50 years, is that technology has advanced so much that corporations are replacing people with robots and automation and computers. I mean, for example, in the 1960s, when you had a certified public accounting firm, let's say you had a small office that had 50 people in it. Well, most of those 50 people, let's say 40 of those people were just bookkeepers, and you only had 10 true accountants. Well, after the computer revolution, you don't need those 40 bookkeepers.
Right, you don't.
You don't.
The machine does the work. Yeah.
Because the machine does the work, you know.
And even if you do need people, now you can hire them in India or, you know, you can hire them overseas for a fraction of the cost of what it costs you to hire them in America. So
that's correct. And, you know, if you read some of the true news on the net, and I even think Fox News had an article on this and had a little piece on this, mm-hmm. is that here in the States, there's like 100 million people needing government assistance in some way, shape, or form. Now,
right.
that's a staggering figure. You know, I'm not saying that every single one of those 100 million people is actually on public aid. You know, they're working, mm-hmm. but they need it, right?
Yeah,
they need medical assistance and stuff.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, it's to the point here where we are actually in a second Great Depression. The
mm-hmm.
difference is we have enough government transfer payments, government assistance, you know, to kind of mask the problem on how bad the economy is. So, you know, they're kind of covering up that, too. And you see on the mm-hmm. news, they're talking about unemployment being 6% or 7% or 8% nationwide.
It's much more than that.
You know, they're not really counting the people who have fallen off the system and
right.
are still not employed and are not being
That's
counted.
Right.
So, you know, I remember reading an article not long ago. I think the unemployment rate for the young people is like as high as 30%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the true unemployment rate is more around the 15% to 20% mark.
And that's,
so,
I mean, that really is what you need for a revolution. Young people who are unhappy.
Right. And you, young people unhappy. This is kind of a sad thing. It's crossed my mind a couple of times. But for this revolution really to come, and when I say revolution, I'm not talking about an actual physical war. I'm talking about a revolution.
A social revolution, right.
Yeah,
yeah,
a social revolution of a heart and of the
right.
mind. And kind of the sad thing is, and it's truth, so I go ahead and say it, is that not until the baby boomers die off
mm-hmm.
will there be enough room for the social revolution to actually take place.
Yeah.
Because the baby boomers really control the politics of the country right now, as well as
mm-hmm.
the corporations. You
yeah.
know, so until, you know, the next 20 to 30 years, until they get out of the way and let the young people come up and,
mm-hmm.
and you know, start having some control, then some change can happen. And, of course, the beautiful thing is our country is dedicated to peaceful revolution. It's really very simple. John Lennon said it best in 1971 with his peace protest. He said, the people have the power. The people have always had the power.
They just don't know it.
Yeah.
They don't
yeah.
know it. But look at what happened to John Lennon. What happened to John Lennon is highly suspicious. So his
yes,
message must have been extremely important. There's every evidence that Hinckley was a Manchurian candidate. I mean, just sitting down and waiting to be arrested. Come on.
Well,
that's hypnosis. That has to be hypnosis.
It's not just John Lennon. Before John Lennon, there was Robert F. Kennedy. And
mm-hmm.
before Robert F. Kennedy, there was Martin Luther King Jr.
Luther King. That was
and
just recent
it,
anniversary
and,
of that,
and,
yes.
And before him, there was
yeah.
John F. Kennedy.
Yeah.
So,
anybody who has the correct message to bring the people out of their, you know, sheeple and slumber state, suddenly isn't here. Very interesting.
Right. And one of the fascinating aspects about John F. Kennedy that I have read about, I don't know if it's absolutely true or not, but
mm-hmm.
not only did Kennedy want to get out of Vietnam, he also wanted to start printing greenbacks and get away from
the Oh, I think you have to look at the money. You have
yep.
to look at the threat to the Federal Reserve to really understand history. Because every time that's threatened, things happen.
Right.
Every time.
And there's a long history of that, too. This goes back to the early part of the 20th century, and it's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Just to look at the facts themselves, in 1909, you have the federal income tax coming into the Constitution. Before
mm-hmm.
1909, a federal income tax was unconstitutional.
Right.
They had to amend the Constitution.
Right,
exactly. What changed? It's all about business. Then, 5 years later, in 1914, you have the Federal Reserve Act coming in. In 1921, you have the creation of the Council on Foreign Relations. Okay? You know, then you have a great big war, World War II, and the whole changing of the power structure of the world. Then in 1973, you have the Trilateral Commission coming into play. Okay? And then after that, then you see the presidents start talking about a new world order.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you know, that brings us up to date on what's going on. If you go on the web and you type in New World Order, you get a gazillion hits on New World Order.
Yeah. So, you know, the hope is that we're going to actually have some maybe global currency revaluation where we go back to a system where the currencies of the world are actually based on something. And, you know,
basically a value, yes.
Right. So, you know, the pendulum may be swinging the other way. We may actually have some things coming into play that will help stop the, you know, the domination by the corporations and the families and the printing, just, you know, the fiat currency dollar just being printed whenever it's needed. You know, some controls have to come back into place. Basel III coming into play so that there's actually regulation in banking, which is sorely needed. So, you know, all of these, there are things coming into play that may be helping the situation and helping to control the, you know, the financial out-of-control scenarios we've been seeing. But we are coming up on the end of our hour, and I do want to give you a chance to give your contact information.
Okay. I don't have a website right now, but you can reach me on Facebook under Ed Malkowski. You have message me or friend me. You can also get my books on Amazon.com. You can also go down to your Barnes & Noble. I think Books A Million should also carry my books. And if you can't find them there, you can go to my publisher, InnerTraditions.com, and order them.
Great. And you want to spell your last name so people can write that down if they need to?
Sure. It's Malkowski.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a delightful discussion, and we've only just really touched the topics in the book.
I know.
We didn't really get – we'll have to have you back on so we can finish the discussion, because we haven't really gotten to a lot of the important points in the book. But it is a very fascinating book, and one that I really recommend people read. Return of the Golden Age, Ancient History, and the Key to Our Collective Future. Thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Susan.
Okay, next week, join us for Temple of Health Radio Show. We're going to be interviewing Dr. Susan Martinez, The Mysterious Origins of Hybrid Man, Crossbreeding and the Unexpected Family Tree of Humanity. And then on the 1st of March, the Council of Light, Divine Transmissions for Manifesting the Deepest Desires of the Soul. And then Eva Hare will be on the next week, Consciousness Bridging the Gap Between Conventional Science and the New Super Science of Quantum Mechanics. Very pleased to have Noetic Science next week, the 20th of February at the Dunwoody office. Tricia McKinnon will be talking about discovering your life's purpose, astrology, and working with the archetypes. And a free movie on the 25th, Dr. Mike Greenberg will be having a discussion at the Millennium Healthcare on the 25th at 7:15 p.m. Thank you very much for joining us, and join us next week.